Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of The Call of Nature. We are a grassroots nature podcast for everyday people. Now, Pete and Chris have let me loose on the introduction this week, so if you are a new listener, this is your primary co-host, welcome you to the show. And if you're an existing listener, welcome back, and we've got a great show lined up for you this week. But first of all, the disclaimer. Pete.
The views and opinions expressed in The Call of Nature are those of whoever expressed them and do not reflect those of any other organisation or agency.
Thank you. So, coming up this week, we've got a nature piece from Lynn, one of our listeners. Chris is giving us his quickfire woodlouse facts. And then we've got Phil, one of our listeners, who got in touch via Twitter, telling about a magic moment he had in Cardiff Bay. And then we've got Stephen telling us about the magnificent world of reptiles and amphibians. Right, so it's been a really warm week. Has it been a good week for nature spotting? Chris, Pete, what have you seen?
Well, Chris actually came down to visit yesterday, and yep, it was hot as hell. We were thinking about the beach, but we didn't want to be rammed in with everybody else in Devon on the beach or stuck in a traffic jam on the way to the beach. So we took the kids, our individual kids, to Ashcliffe Forest, which is a beautiful National Trust bit of land near Exeter, partly to get into the shade. Because my boy and I both are highly susceptible to sunburn, and it was brilliant. We had a lovely walk. We only had 6 or 7 tantrums, didn't we, Chris?
We did, and they were by the kids, not by us, so that's good.
Yeah. So that was a bonus.
I was about to say how many were the kids.
Yeah, all of it, 100% this time. And the really magical part was the butterflies. There were loads of butterflies flying about, and on one particular corner, there were loads of silver-washed fritillaries. And in episode 1, we talked about how much we liked those. So it was great to have the kids watching them flying around. I know your magic moment was for the week was from the same visit, wasn't it, Chris?
Yeah, that's right, Pete. We got to test out one of the technology recommendations that I made in the previous episode called BirdNet. We were both fairly convinced that there was a flock of long-tailed tits flitting around in the trees above us. So we were like, oh, let's test out that thing, see if it works. Turned it on, and it said that they were goldcrests. And we were like, oh, is that right? Is that? I'm not sure that's right. And then after about a couple of 30 seconds or whatever, we looked up and there were some goldcrests. So we weren't going to tell anyone about that because we want to appear like we're nature experts. We're obviously not. That was a really fun trip the other day, Pete. I enjoyed that. I had one other little nature highlight this week was when I was sitting at my desk at work, and I looked up and there was something buzzing up against the window, and I was like, oh, that looks quite big. And it was a hornet that had flown into the office. And they're like massive wasps, and it wasn't very pleased to be in the office, but I managed to catch it and impress everyone with my bravery. and I caught it in a little Tupperware box and then went and let it outside. I was more worried about letting it out and it being really angry than catching it, but I managed to get some photos, so I'll stick those up on the social media so people can see it. Gareth, did you have a nature highlight this week?
I did, and I've got to admit it was actually a bird after all my jibber-jabber the other week about stuff. So I was sat in the garden, and there's this really old sort of variety of bramble that grows in one corner of my garden that my neighbour's really excited about, telling me it's like the best blackberries ever. And anyway, it's been profuse with fruit, and I did try them. They are pretty tasty, but this like young blackbird came and it was pecking away at them, taking them off and off. And then it kind of sort of stopped and you could see it had its fill, and it just chilled out on the fence, just sat there literally for like 25 minutes, just sat on the fence next to me. And it was great.
It didn't hop onto your shoulder?
No, next step. I'll have to train it a bit more for that.
Next step, yeah. They're great. I love blackbirds. They're fantastic. They're one of the few species that I've managed to persuade to eat out of my hand, actually. Robins are the ones that people get to do it, but I've had blackbirds doing it as well.
Nice.
So my nature moment was really close to home this week, and Pete's had a chat with Lynn, who's founded her special nature place, which is really close to her as well.
Welcome back, Lynn. Thanks for joining us again.
It's my pleasure.
So today, after speaking with us last time about veganism, you're going to talk to us about your favourite nature place, aren't you? Because we asked you to and you said yes. So thank you for that. What is your favourite nature place, Lynn?
Well, I've visited a lot of nature reserves over the years and there's some amazing ones out there. But I have to say, my favourite nature place is my own wildlife garden at home.
Lovely.
And it's just, it's been such a sort of oasis of calm during these strange times. And it's really blossomed this year. I don't think that's just because we've spent more time in it. It just seems to have come to fruition finally. So, yeah, I moved in with my partner about 4 years ago, and he kind of got this garden, which was nothing really. It was just a fenced bit of land. There was nothing in there apart from a buddleia. And over the years, we've just sort of, we've planned different areas, and it's kind of looking really beautiful. So we've got a big native hedge, which has taken 3 years to sort of get to about 6 foot high. So it's looking like a proper hedge now.
We talked about native plants in the last episode. Is that something you sought out deliberately?
Definitely, yeah. I wanted to have hazels and berry plants as well, so there's plenty in there for the birds. And it's great because we get little gangs of sparrows in there and all sorts whizzing in and out. And I think the thing I'm waiting for next is for maybe a blackbird or something to make a nest in there. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah. That's great. And what other areas have you got?
So we've got two ponds. We've got a pond that's been there for a while that my partner put in, and he's put it in so there's different levels and lots of planting around the edges because we've got a lot of newts and they like to sort of use the foliage around the edges to lay eggs. And we've got lots of pond skaters and water beetles. But yesterday I was really excited because I was sitting on the bench in my little wildlife area and there was a frog, a really big frog. So it made my day, that did.
Well, congratulations, Lynn. And of course, I already congratulated you because I saw a photo of your very handsome new arrival on your Wild Homes UK Instagram profile. And I believe that's on Twitter as well, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah. And anything exciting goes on there. There's a lovely picture of a speckled bush cricket that I found as well. I was sort of in the garden picking some fruit and it suddenly appeared in front of me and I knew it was a cricket, but I did have to look it up. But I picked up on your point from one of your previous podcasts about using Seek. And so I've been using that a bit more because I always had it on my phone. I just hadn't actually used it. It's quite good, isn't it?
It is. Has that been helping you with the ID then?
Yeah, because my big thing this year has been creating more wildflower areas because we've always had maybe about a quarter of the garden is left along grass and we don't mow it. We don't touch it. And it's full of grasshoppers and crickets and slowworms. But this year I decided there was too much grass and not enough wildflowers. And so I've put in lots, but I didn't know all of them. So so I had to use the Seek app just to check out what I've actually got there. But it's great. It's really looking nice, especially the cornflowers, my favourite.
Yeah, they're beautiful flowers, aren't they, Lynn? So something we talked about in the last episode and I was a bit shocked about was the amount of non-native wildflowers in seed mixes which people get. How have you got on with growing native species in your garden?
Well, it's been a bit hit and miss. So I took some advice from one of the National Trust rangers and he suggested to put a bit of lime in the soil to get the alkalinity down because our soil is really good, which is great for the veg but not for the wildflowers, and it seems to have worked quite well. We have got quite a lot of wildflowers coming through now. And I did actually buy a few as well. I did cheat and I bought a few. I bought some corn cockles and knapweed because I couldn't get them to grow.
Well, I think that's a very good solution. I'm sure the insects won't mind where they came from, will they?
No, exactly.
Well, what our listeners won't know is it's first thing in the morning. I don't think either of us would probably describe ourselves as morning people, would we?
No. I didn't sleep very well either with this heat. It's horrible.
It is. Well, I couldn't tell, Lynn. So thank you very much for joining us and for telling us all about your garden.
Oh, it's been great. Yeah. If you're over this way anytime, pop in and see it.
I certainly will, Lynn. I certainly will. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye now.
Oh, Pete, that was a really interesting chat. And one of the things I noticed is that Lynn had planted a lot of stuff and she was starting to see these wildflowers come through. And I think it's something really good that you can do in your gardens. Often when you're working in nature conservation in the countryside, people are very careful about managing the land different and seeing what comes through so we don't sort of alter or introduce anything. But in your gardens, it's a great place to speed up nature's recovery by adding things in. I do it in my own garden and things will come back really quickly like that frog. But one of the things you'll see almost immediately is the subject of this next feature.
That's right, Gareth. And I wanted to talk a little bit now about a very familiar creature that every one of our listeners will have seen, but they might not know some of the weird and wonderful facts about them. And that creature is the woodlouse. So I've got a load of interesting and fun facts that I'm going to hit you guys in the studio with here. So, did you know that woodlice are the world's only land-based crustacean, same as lobsters, shrimps, crabs, etc.? And actually, if you cook them up, they taste like prawns.
hang on a minute. You're not telling us that you've eaten woodlice, surely?
I haven't myself, but I believe Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, you know that guy with the hair that does the TV stuff? He's done it, and he said they taste like prawns, and I believe him. So you can find woodlice almost anywhere that's dark and damp. They need a damp environment to survive because they absorb and lose water through their bodies, through their shells, but they can't survive underwater. Now, they've got many funny local names or nicknames, and there's been well over 150 that have been recorded, including Bibble Bug, Chisel Hog, Palmer Worm, Monkey Pea, Chuggy Pig, Roly Poly, Johnny Grump and Cheesy Bob.
Can I just quickly add in the Isle of Wight Mally Shag?
The what now?
The Mally Shag, that's the Isle of Wight name for them.
Was that a member of your family or something?
No, it's a genuine word. I don't know how it came about, best not to ask.
Yeah. Another fun fact is that woodlice are marsupial, like kangaroos. They keep their eggs in a patch, and when they hatch into the pouch, and they live in there safely for a few days before they're big enough to emerge into the outside world, much like kangaroos. They've got some other quite interesting, quirky bodily functions. So they have gills, some of them, to breathe like fish. You know, some of them have these gill-like structures, which are like branched tubes called pseudotracheae. And some of them have lungs as well. Very odd. They don't urinate at all. So most animals need to get rid of ammonia. Ammonia is produced when most animals break down protein in their food. And most of them do it by converting it into less harmful chemicals like urea and peeing it out or excreting it as guano if you're a bird. But woodlice can just evaporate this ammonia through their shells as a gas, which is pretty unique.
Is that what you were doing on Sunday, Chris?
Evaporating stuff through my shell. It was pretty hot, but no, that was just farting, sorry. But it might contribute to them smelling not so great and some of those nicknames. They also they drink water through both ends, both their mouth and their anus, which is interesting and not something, not the sort of animal you'd want to take down the pub for a drink. Maybe it might be a bit embarrassing. Their blood is blue because they use copper rather than iron to fix oxygen in their blood. And this is a remnant of their crustacean evolution. But they also have to eat their poop in order to recycle the copper back into their bodies. So, yeah, not great table manners. If they were in the pub with you and they got into a fight, they've got a few defence mechanisms. They roll into a little hard-plated ball. And that's quite a fun thing to do. If you find woodlice, you can poke them around on your hand and they'll do that. They also discharge a type of glue that can entangle predators like beetles and centipedes, spiders and stuff like that. And they have these little things on the back end of their body that release this foul-smelling substance when they're faced with danger. So, yeah, That's one way to get out of a fight, I suppose. They're all born male, but some change to females later in life. And woodlice often get infected by a bacteria which causes them to change sex, changing to girls if they're boys. So there we go. Those are my funny facts about woodlice.
I've got to say, it sounds like a complicated and unpleasant life to be a woodlouse. I have a lot more respect for them.
Very different, right? Because they're only just these little grey insects. You can find them anywhere. But yeah, some seriously weird biology and habits. So next time you're out and you see a little woodlouse in the park or something, you can run it over to the nearest person and tell them how they eat their own poo and drink through their bum holes. It's a surefire way to impress people and sound cool.
Or maybe get arrested.
Well, Chris, you've surprised me there. I've seen these things crawling around all my life, and I didn't know any of those things about them. And I'd be prepared to bet that very few other people did as well. And just please reassure me that you don't eat woodlice.
I don't. Not unless I'm really hungry.
Well, that's good to know. So from one relation of a seed dweller, we're going to move in the direction of another. This time, Gareth's chatting with listener Phil, who, thank you very much, Phil, contacted us via Twitter to tell him his magic moment in Cardiff Bay.
Okay, Phil, thanks for joining us on the Call of Nature. I think you're our first person to get in touch who's seen something in Wales. So you had a bit of an unusual sighting. Could you describe it to us?
Okay, well, I live in Cardiff, and around late June, I took a drive down to Cardiff Bay and went for a bit of a walk along the barrage, which actually occurred to me as I was driving down there that since the lockdown started, this was actually the first time I'd seen the sea, which probably gives an idea of how small our worlds have become in the last few months.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, even though I only actually live about 3 miles from the Bristol Channel. So we walked along the barrage, which is a great big dam that was built in the 90s and basically turned Cardiff Bay into a great big lake. And we stopped by the lock gates that let boats in and out of the bay. And we were actually just about to move on from there when we looked down and there was this seal bobbing up and down in the water. Just every now and again, he would dive down and then a few minutes later come up for air, bob about for it and then go back down again. I presume he was trying to catch fish. I've since spoken to a seal expert on Twitter who seemed to think he was a young adult male grey seal. And while we were watching him, this guy turned up and he started to take a few photos and he told us that this seal had actually been there for about the past 3 weeks. So made it his home just on the outside of the lock gates. And he's become a little bit of a mini local celebrity in Cardiff over the last few weeks. And people have been sharing pictures and videos of him on social media and we've had people running down to the bay trying to catch a glimpse of him.
I've got to ask, has he got a name? Because they often are named.
Not that I'm aware of. We probably should give him one.
Well, I think maybe you should coin one as one of the first people to spot him.
Cedric. Should we call him Cedric?
Sounds good.
I've actually seen seals before in Scotland and in Iceland, but I've never seen one before in Cardiff Bay up until now. But what there is, right by the lock gates, there's a fish pass that lets the fish get in and out of the bay. He was probably regarding it as like, you know, one of those conveyor belts they have on sushi bars.
Oh, he sounds like a smart seal. I mean, pretty much open your mouth and it goes straight in.
But he certainly seemed to be living his best life.
Well, that's excellent. I mean, thanks for coming on to tell us about it. I mean, like you said, it's such a lovely sight to see something which sometimes feels really distant. And I understand, Phil, that you are a fellow podcaster, which is quite interesting. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, my podcast, it's slightly different to yours in that it's called Unfashionably Internationalist. And the idea is to talk about internationalism and unity across nations. Sometimes they're quite political episodes. Like, for example, I recently did an episode with a Polish activist talking about how she's combating the far right in Poland. And sometimes it's still internationalist, but less political. Like I recently did a movie review about the Netflix Eurovision movie, where I talked to an Icelander about what the movie gets right and wrong about Iceland. But I guess one thing that perhaps has in common with your podcast is that It's a podcast that I set up as basically an attempt to stay sane in what are very difficult times.
I think that's a really great thing to do, Phil. And I think one of the things as an ecologist I'd always say is that wildlife doesn't really identify with any boundaries that humans draw on maps. So it's quite a pertinent thing to think about.
Yeah. Yeah, that seal certainly doesn't have a passport.
Well, that was great, Gareth. And I haven't seen a seal in years. I think probably the last time was in a little harbour up on the west coast of Scotland somewhere. One of the things I love about seeing seals, particularly when they're in the water, is they sort of pop up and you're excited to see them. But they almost look quite inquisitive about and excited to see you too, which is a sort of next level nature experienced in my book.
Yeah.
One of the fun things about making this podcast is that we get to meet people who make other podcasts, and Phil's one of those. But another one who we met recently is a guy called Stephen Allain, and we had a chat with him about reptiles and amphibians, and here it is.
Now then, folks, we're very lucky to be joined today, Chris and I, moonlighting with another wildlife expert while Gareth's busy doing his thing, and that is Steve Allain, who is an expert on reptiles and amphibians, so that's very exciting. Stephen is a PhD student at the University of Kent. He's been working for a decade in amphibian conservation around the country, and is also a contributor to the excellent UK Wildlife podcast, which we recommend to you all. So, Stephen, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
So, Stephen, when I talk to some of my friends who maybe aren't into wildlife quite as much as I am, and I start talking about snakes and lizards and things like that, they're always quite surprised to know that we have so much in this country. Maybe they've seen them in the Mediterranean or something when they've been on holiday, but there are quite a few species that we have in the UK, aren't there?
There are, yes. So despite what most people think, we do have, you know, a number of reptiles here. Well, six to be exact. We have three species of lizards and three species of snakes that are native anyway. You know, a couple of them are very widespread across the country, and you can find them in parks and gardens as well as on nature reserves and you know, other wild places. But a few of them are quite range restricted, such as the smooth snake and the sand lizard, which are only found typically on sandy dune systems in the south of England, although sand lizards are also found in parts of Wales and up on the Sefton coast in the north of England. And yes, people are always surprised when I tell them, you know, just like you, that there are reptiles here in the UK. And I think that they always associate them with a tropical climate or somewhere where, as you said, it's more warm. You know, they don't think that rainy, blighty is the sort of place that you'd expect to come across a lizard or a snake. And typically, our species of lizards are very small. And, you know, the common lizard, or viviparous lizard, as is also known, you know, grows to about 6 inches in length, 15 centimetres. Sand lizards are slightly larger. They're about 20 centimetres in length. And then slow worms, which are a legless species of lizard, which are sometimes confused with snakes, are up to 45 centimetres in length. And I think that their small size and the fact that not many people are aware that they're there leads to this confusion over whether or not we have reptiles in the UK to begin with.
People are so surprised when they see them quite often, aren't they? Especially if they've not seen stuff before. I get lizards in the cemetery near me sometimes basking on the gravestones. It's a roasting hot day today. I should imagine now's probably quite a good time to go out and see them.
Yes, with the heat wave we've been having, it's you know, it's a great time to go out and see reptiles. Although you want to avoid the heat of the midday sun, the best time to see them is first thing in the morning or late in the afternoon. And yeah, as you say, they'll be out basking on areas that are exposed to the sun, you know, south-facing banks, in your case, gravestones and, you know, and the like there, but also fallen logs and other features that give them that thermal advantage to be able to collect the warmth they need from the sun to get up to their operating temperature and then, you know, go about and explore, find some food, and then afterwards sit down, rest and digest.
That's very interesting, Stephen. So that's a good tip for everybody. When we were chatting the other day, when I was on the beach down in Dorset fossil hunting, you told me that a lot of people aren't that keen on reptiles. So that's a surprise to me, and amphibians, I should say. Why is that, do you think?
I think the issue is that people just aren't exposed to, you know, reptiles and amphibians on a daily basis. You know, amphibians are quite explosive breeders in the spring and they disappear. And as we've already mentioned, people aren't aware that we have reptiles. And so unless you're exposed to them, you know, you can't have positive experiences with them. And a lot of people rely on the media, on, you know, social media, the news, TV and movies in order to get the information about these animals. And of course, a lot of that can be false. You know, they haven't had the chance to form those positive associations. And so people, without even, you know, seeing the animals, associate them with evil, dump places, you know, all sorts of, you know, negative connotations, when really the opposite is true. And, you know, I often feel that if people had never seen a bird before, and then suddenly, you know, they came across, you know, just a pigeon, you know, they'd be pretty scared and, you know, pretty confused as well. But yeah, I think that that's why we have this disconnect between the general public and some of our nature, particularly when it comes to the reptiles and amphibians, is just people aren't aware of their existence. They aren't looking at them. They aren't seeing them. And so they don't have the chance to be able to appreciate them for what they really are.
Yeah, that makes sense, Stephen. And I can understand there's a lot of psychology behind people's sort of how people feel about different creatures. It's quite complicated. Now, you've kindly offered to come on the show again and talk to us about all sorts of stuff to do with reptiles and amphibians. So we look forward to having you on again and asking some more questions. But for those of us who want to help out, how can people get involved with helping out with the conservation of these creatures?
Thank you very much. And yes, you know, there are lots of people that can do, you know, creating garden ponds and, you know, trying to get involved with stuff locally. But one of the easiest ways that people can help is by recording the wildlife they see, and particularly when it comes to reptiles and amphibians. Obviously, you can't save a species if you don't know where it occurs, you know, in terms of its habitats, its distribution, etc. And so there's a website called Recordpool, recordpool.org.uk, that is coordinated by the Amphibian and Reptile Conservation Trust and the Amphibian Reptile Groups UK. And it's a portal where anybody can casually record sightings of reptiles and amphibians in a local area. That information then gets fed through to local conservation groups such as ARC or the ARGs, which are volunteer groups that are out there helping to manage habitat and survey for reptiles and amphibians. And yeah, the portal relies on records from members of the public, you know, whether you're out walking a dog and you see a lizard, or, you know, you find a frog in your pond, etc. All of that adds up and it helps to put dots on map and create a much larger base of knowledge and information to show where in the landscape these animals exist and potentially persist.
Yeah, that's great. So I'd encourage all of our listeners to get involved in that sort of thing. Technology and citizen science is so valuable in helping us to understand species and how we can help them and where they're in trouble and where they're doing well. So get involved, everybody. That'd be great.
Yes, I agree, Chris. And we'll certainly share links to Record Pool through our social media. Well, thank you very much, Steve. We very much appreciate you coming on the show. It's been very interesting and we really look forward to getting you on another episode very soon.
I look forward to taking part.
Thanks, Steve.
So at the end there, Chris mentioned citizen science, and I thought it might be worth just stopping for a second to have a bit of a chat about this, because not everyone will know what it is. The idea of citizen science is it helps anyone get involved in scientific research, and really good citizen science is collaborative. I think a lot of academic researchers used to see it as a great way to get lots of information collected for free by sending people out to go and monitor things. But proper citizen science is really collaborative, and there's some fantastic things out there. There's one that always springs to mind, and in Victorian times, you used to have these old vicars who used to, in their spare time when they weren't in church, do lots and lots of botany and collect lots of plant samples. And these have all been scanned in online on something called herbarium. And people become experts in identifying these different samples. And they use that to map how the vegetation across Britain's changed over sort of hundreds of years. So there's some really good things out there. And proper citizen science is collaborative. It's not about just having lots of people to go and do your work for you, which I'm sure a lot of scientists would love to have. It's about actually collaborating with people and understanding their knowledge, which might be different from yours. And it's a really great thing. And if you get the chance to get involved, I definitely would.
Yeah, it's a fun thing to do as well. And it's a way that you can learn lots about the stuff that you might be studying as a newcomer. there's a great thing that butterfly conservation do for monitoring butterflies every year, where they take a snapshot same time every year. And you can see, you can map out populations of different types of butterfly. But as a sort of participant, you also get, you know, you'll come across stuff and you'll be like, I don't know what that is. And you learn it. And it's just a really nice way to get people involved in actually doing some science. And you get a, like this big sample set as well, don't you, as a scientist, that would be almost impossible to achieve by sending out actual scientists.
Absolutely. And as we're starting to see some of the impacts of climate change on our species, it's really important to have people across the length of Britain and further afield looking at the slight changes, subtle changes in where wildlife is and where it isn't, so we can really understand what do we need to do to our landscape to enable species to adapt to climate change.
So there you go, folks, citizen science. Now, in episode 7 of The Call of Nature, we've had a nature place from Lynn, we've had a creature feature from Chris, and we've had a magic moment from Phil. And these are the sorts of things that we're hoping that you'd like to come on the show and tell us about, folks. They can be spectacular. They can be every day. You might be an expert. You might barely know what happened. But if it impressed you and it made you smile, we'd love to hear from you. So please get a hold of us via all of our social media channels or on thecallofnature.co.uk. Tell us about what happened and we'd love to get you on. It's all about sharing enthusiasm for nature with everybody else. That's what we want to do. So that brings us to the end of the show. Thank you to all of our new listeners. Thank you to all of our regular listeners. And we really hope that we'll see you next time.
Bye.